Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
There's a dance style called stepping. It's a tradition at historically black colleges across the South and across the country. So how did a winning team at this year's National Step-Off in Atlanta go from this to this? A white team wins at a black competition and touches off yet another American controversy over race. Does owning your cultural identity mean you get to own your culture? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 5th. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, who's a little under the weather this morning, but I'm here with Celeste Headlee, of course.
And let's get right to the top headlines today. Two police officers were wounded in a shootout outside the Pentagon last night. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Keevil says the gunman, 36-year-old John Patrick Beadle, approached a security checkpoint and...
As the officers started to ask him for his pass to get into the Pentagon, he drew a weapon from his pocket and started shooting immediately off. So he didn't say anything. He just engaged the officers.
They returned fire with their semi-automatic weapons, killing the suspect. Doctors say the officers were only grazed and will be okay. This morning, we're learning the shooter reportedly posted messages on the internet showing resentment against the military and doubting the facts behind the September 11th attacks.
Across the Potomac now in Washington, President Obama is urging the House to make progress on health care reform before he leaves for Asia in 2 weeks. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says while she's generally confident about the way ahead, nothing is certain.
Every legislative vote is a heavy lift around here. You assume nothing. In terms of where you were before and where people may be now. You start one, two, three, four, all the way up.
President Obama met with more than a dozen House Democrats yesterday to drum up support for the health reform bill, telling them it's the opportunity of a lifetime. Meanwhile, the House passed a jobs bill mostly along party lines yesterday. It gives companies that hire the jobless a temporary payroll tax break, but some Democrats argued the $35 billion bill is too small.
Meanwhile, moving now to Chile, where in the last 2 hours, a strong 6.3 magnitude aftershock struck the city of Concepcion, sending people running into the streets. There have been 150 aftershocks since last weekend's earthquake. And overseas, Iraqis living abroad have begun casting ballots in their homeland's parliamentary elections scheduled for Sunday. Thousands are lining up at stations in Syria, home of the largest Iraqi expatriate community. More than 2 million Iraqis fled the country after the U.S.-led invasion. Iraqi forces have taken over the security in the country, leaving U.S. troops mostly in the background. This American platoon leader tells NBC News it's time for the U.S. forces to pull out.
Say if you trained all your life to be a doctor and then you came to a country and all you did was help out doctors. You had to stay in the waiting room and basically try and help them out the best you can. It's basically what we're doing here. You know, it's kind of frustrating at times, but it's necessary.
Security will be heightened for Sunday's election. And here at home, the unemployment numbers for February will come out in a little over 2 hours. We'll get this to you as soon as we get them. Economists expect a small rise to 9.8%. Looking at the markets, global markets are up on the news. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,444. The S&P opens at 1,122 and the NASDAQ at 2,292.
Now, coming up later in the show, we'll talk about a controversy where in Atlanta, a team of white dancers won a competition in stepping. That's a traditionally black form of dance. LaToya Peterson, editor of the website Racialicious, joins us now. LaToya, did you see the Zetas, the white team that from the University of Arkansas?
Yeah, I saw both of the videos for the Zetas and the AKAs.
And did you think that the Zetas deserved to win? They were pronounced the winners of this competition.
Yeah, I mean, that one was more of a judgment call. The Zetas routine was very tightly choreographed, and they parodied a really popular existing program, Matrix, whereas the AKAs was a lot more interpretive. And so they did kind of their own individual freestyle. It was a lot more like a dance and a little bit less like stepping.
All right, LaToya Peterson.
Hang
on, LaToya, because the competition became about a lot more than just how well they dance. And we want to ask you, would you judge a team of white dancers differently than a team of black dancers in a competition? Black competition. 8778-MY-TAKE. MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Music. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John this morning. He's a little bit under the weather, but I am here with Celeste. We're going to have that conversation about a white step company from University of Arkansas that won a traditionally black competition and what it has said about the controversy and conversation over race and cultural identity in this country. But before we get to that, another important story this morning on an issue that affects millions and millions of men across America, and it's prostate cancer and prostate cancer screening. Remember a couple of months ago, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force in Washington adjusted guidelines and said that women over 40 don't necessarily need a mammogram, and it caused a gigantic controversy and dust up in Washington and around the country. Well, the same thing might happen now with prostate cancer screening. There might be some confusion. The American Cancer Society now says the blood test used for screening can do more harm than good for the millions of American men who are screened every year routinely. The new guidelines say doctors shouldn't rush into early screenings and should give every patient more information on the limits of those tests before they recommend them to their patients. Now, Dr. Peter Schlegel is urologist in chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital and the Weill Cornell Medical Center, and he joins us now. Good morning, Dr. Schlegel.
Good morning.
Bring us up to speed, please, on what the American Cancer Society is now saying about prostate cancer screening.
So the American Cancer Society has dropped back from saying that PSA screening, the most common type of prostate cancer screening, should be offered, to saying that PSA screening should be discussed, in large part because of two new studies.
And what do those studies say?
Those studies do not show as much benefit to PSA screening as we would have thought.
Now, is this because of the nature of the prostate-specific antigen, the PSA test, or the nature of prostate cancer itself? One of the things about prostate cancer is it grows really slowly. It's not as dangerous as some other kinds of cancers.
Well, that's a critical point. For prostate cancer to grow from the point where it can be detected to where it causes death may take 15 or 20 years, and these studies are relatively young. They're only 7 to 10 years old.
So because the studies have a relatively short time span, we may not necessarily know what happens to most men over the natural lifespan of your average prostate cancer.
Exactly. These studies have not shown clear evidence of benefit, but that doesn't mean that the PSA blood test has no benefit for patients.
So that's the gray area there, and it's the gray area in so much of this so-called routine screening, Dr. Schlegel. How does a physician like you now approach a patient? Do you now say, don't get it, it's not worth it? What do you say?
Well, I think what's important to remember is occasionally you will find prostate cancers that do not require treatment. There can be some very small prostate cancers that are not important that we now detect. So before you actually test a patient, you have to have more of a discussion of what that testing may lead to or what you may do with those results.
Meaning if it's positive, here's what it could mean for you.
Exactly.
And there are side effects of prostate cancer aside from just the illness itself. I would assume from the treatment has potential downsides.
Well, the testing may lead to a biopsy. A biopsy may lead to a treatment. The biopsy itself is not very dangerous, but the treatments can result in urinary problems. It can result in other quality of life issues that are important to take into account.
Well, one of the most important issue here is the patient and what the doctor's advice to the patient actually means for them. And we're lucky enough to have Jeff Jarvis with us. He's a friend of the show, and he's been quite public about his own prostate cancer diagnosis and his screening. Jeff is a media and technology writer and author of What Would Google Do? Jeff, good morning.
Good morning.
You were diagnosed with prostate cancer last summer at 55, right?
Right, and to discuss the benefit that is in question here, that's really a statistical question of whether or not it saves money in the long run. From an individual perspective, I benefited. My cancer was found. I got it out of me. That's my choice. I wanted the data about that, and I'm very glad that it happened.
So, Jeff Jarvis, what you're saying actually, in a way, seems to support what the American Cancer Society is saying. This should be more individualized between you and your doctor, that not every man should necessarily get this.
No, I'm not saying that, because I think that everyone, I'm telling every friend I have to go get it tested. Why not? We should know what's happening inside of us. And I think that to make it a policy to put a blind eye up because it might cause some cost or inconvenience later, is not the right way to go. I had a small cancer. I chose to take it out at Sloan Kettering. Today, I'm glad to say today my incontinence is over, but I'm still impotent. These things are not easy for men to talk about. It's hard for us to talk about our penises at all, but especially when they don't work. But I think it's very important for us to talk publicly about this because breast cancer gets much more attention and thus much more treatment than prostate cancer, and yet we're doing the exact opposite and saying, oh, well, no, you don't really have to do that. Well, so, what I'm saying is that it's up to each patient to decide in the end what they want to know about their body and not to be swayed by this effort to not have a test. I can't imagine putting blinders on. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, Dr. Schlegel, Jeff Jarvis can't imagine putting blinders on. This points up the constant tension between what's best for an individual patient versus choices that have to be made for the whole population. We don't have unlimited resources.
Well, that's certainly true. I think you have to recognize that 20 years ago, the death rate from prostate cancer was high and increasing dramatically. We have halved that death rate from prostate cancer. So clearly PSA blood tests have helped people to have early treatment, to have effective treatment, and saved lives. The question then really comes down to what Mr. Jarvis said. Is that worth it for the society as a whole? And frankly, I'm not sure all physicians understand the issue and what that means.
Jeff Jarvis, do you think that most physicians are spending enough time? Let me ask you this way. Did your physician spend enough time with you that you felt you made an informed decision?
Yes, but you know what? The decision doesn't really come until you know the diagnosis.
Whether it's positive
Dr.
or not.
Dr. Roll Para at Sloan Kettering is my doctor, and he sat down with me at great length once I had the diagnosis to say, here's all your choices, here's the implications. That's when it mattered. I'm not going to pay attention quite as much when it's saying, let's test you for this or that. Let's take a lung x-ray. Yeah, we could find lung cancer, and that could be very painful. That's fairly obvious, isn't it?
Right. And yet, Jeff, just to finish, I mean, a potential downside to this diagnosis, you mentioned incontinence and impotence, and you've had to deal with that as well.
Yeah, but my grandfather died of prostate cancer, and I watched the downsides of not treating it and letting it go too far until it goes into your bones and makes you painful, and it's a miserable death.
All right, Jeff Jarvis, author of What Would Google Do?, friend of the show and prostate cancer survivor, and Dr. Peter Schlegel from New York Presbyterian. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. New prostate cancer guidelines from the American Cancer Society. Now let's check in on some of the stories we're following at quarter past the hour.
A shooting at the Pentagon last night. Police say a man in his 30s, John Patrick Bedell of California, walked up to officers at the subway entrance to the Defense Department and opened fire. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Kievel described the scene.
He was very calm, that there was no distress. He was his arms down in his pocket. We see folks come up to the Pentagon every day. They have their passes in different places. He reached in his pocket. They assumed he was going to get his pass out, and he came out with a gun and just started shooting.
Two officers suffered mild injuries. The suspect, who reports say may have had issues with the military, was shot and killed. Pentagon police say the man's intentions are still unclear. A new report says the number of right-wing patriot groups that see the U.S. government as their enemy more than doubled in the last year. That's according to the Southern Poverty Law Center.
President Obama, meanwhile, wants the House to pass the health care bill before he leaves on a trip to Asia in mid-March. But Republican House Minority Leader John Boehner says the bill may not pass.
This does not have to become law. They are not there yet. And this bill can be defeated.
President Obama summoned more than a dozen House Democrats to the White House yesterday to drum up support for his proposals. Meanwhile, college students across the nation have been protesting higher tuition and proposed budget cuts.
Education must be free, no cuts!
No cuts!
No fees!
No fees!
Education must be free, no cuts!
That's the sound of demonstrators at San Francisco State University. As part of the demonstration, more than 150 people shut down a freeway during rush hour. They were arrested. And that's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, after more than 100 submissions, we reveal the winners of the Takeaway Cat Show.
Breaking news there.
Stay tuned for that.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some takeouts on news stories for you, and we're going to begin with sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. A huge game for college basketball this weekend that doesn't involve Syracuse, right, or Kentucky or any of the top-ranked teams. Ibrahim, a huge game that nobody knows about?
Well, not that no one knows about, but in the Ivy League, there's no tournament. So most of the conferences, the ACC, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Big East, which are the major conferences for college basketball, most of those they go through a regular season, and at the end of the regular season, they seed those teams, and they get put into a tournament. And
March Madness.
Well, that's the beginning of March Madness, because whoever wins that conference tournament then gets an automatic bid to the playoffs, to the NCAA tournament, which is the big March Madness, the big dance. And out of those teams that don't make it, usually because they're a major conference, you pluck a couple teams that are good enough, they've ranked enough, their schedule that they've played against is good enough, so then they get to go to the big dance as well. The conference that I'm talking about this weekend is the only conference in the country that gets an automatic bid, but they don't play a tournament to see who gets that bid, and that's the Ivy League. So throughout the regular season of the Ivy League, which is what they also call the Ancient Eight, some of the oldest universities in the United States, whoever wins that regular season gets an automatic bid for the NCAA. And coming up, the Cornell, Big Red Cornell, has a chance to clinch that record by the end of this if they beat Brown or Yale coming up. And one of our producers really loves Brown, and she informed me there's no way that Cornell is going to beat Brown this week.
Okay, well, here's an interesting statistic. I had no idea. The last time an Ivy League school won a game in the first round of the NCAA tournament was 1998. That was Princeton. And in 25 years, only two Ivy League teams have made it past the first round of play.
When was the last time Kentucky won in the first round of the chess
tournament? So let's say Cornell wins. Are they going to go do that first round of basketball and then they're out?
That's generally what happens. The formula for a successful Ivy League basketball team is that they have a group of veteran players, juniors or seniors, that have had success for a couple of years, and by the time that they've well seasoned, they'll jump into the frying pan of the NCAA. Well, this year you have they have a perfect setup. Cornell has they have Ryan Whitman, Lewis Dale, and Jeff Foote, and they're all seniors, and they really don't want this to happen.
So they're good enough to lose in the first round of the NCAA tournament.
The key thing is how they're seated. So the key thing is if they get seated higher, then they won't play a better team. So we're hoping that Cornell will get seated higher.
Okay, that's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Good morning.
All right, it's Oscars in Hollywood this week, but here at The Takeaway, we have amazing anticipation all week, because it's our cat contest. We've been looking forward to this all week. Sort of happy that John's not here today for this, because he was a little bit down on this whole thing. So
he's not the big domestic pet competition guy.
He's not, but we can give the cat contest to you. Just in case you haven't been paying attention, we've asked you to send us the pictures of your favorite felines. We've received over 100 entries, which we posted at thetakeaway.org on the website for your viewing pleasure. And the voting went on all day yesterday, and now it boils down to this one riveting moment. In third place, we have cat number 34, Jazz Cat, submitted by Karen Altus. In second place, a cat number 108, Sam with one eye, who's looking pretty good. He was submitted by Annabelle Schlossberg. And finally, in first place, Jay, can I get that drum roll? The winner of the prestigious Takeaway Cat Show 2010 is cat number 51, Spanky, the cat in the straw hat, submitted by Jane Bloom. Congratulations, Spanky, and congratulations to all our winners, and thanks to everyone who entered. If you want to see these cats for yourself, head over to thetakeaway.org, and while you're there, listen to cat-by-cat commentary from The Takeaway's own contest curator-at-large, Sarah Montague.
This is a beautiful shot, and also reminds me of a song that Garrison Keillor used to sing, all about how the nature of cats is to want to be on the opposite side of whatever door they are behind. So this one would be singing, "Oh, I want to come in."
Well, you can listen to Sarah and see all of America's cutest doggies and kitties at thetakeaway.org.
And for our last takeout, we go, of course, to you. You had a lot to talk about, not about cats, but teachers. The story we did yesterday was about a survey of 40,000 teachers, and they were asked what they need to do in order to do their job well. And you can catch up by going to our site, thetakeaway.org. But it got us thinking about great teachers, because regardless of whether they had the resources or not, great teachers can inspire students.
My name's Annie Hatala, and I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina. My most influential teacher was Betty Iliopoulos, who was my Spanish teacher all through high school. She was absolutely the most demanding teacher I ever had. She was this woman who made all of her own clothes, drove a pink T-bird, and had a bouffant hairdo. And everyone called her the Dragon Lady because she was just so demanding, but she taught me the best Spanish I ever could have learned, and because of her, I went on to study Spanish. I now have a master's in Spanish and teach for the University of South Carolina, all because of Betty Iliopoulos.
The Dragon Lady. We've been getting stories like this about teachers all day at thetakeaway.org, and from your calls to 877-8-MY-TAKE. And one of the things that I think we learned from listeners consistently is that the best teachers were not necessarily the nicest.
My ninth grade geometry teacher, one day he stood over me, all 6'2" of him, and said, "If you ever show up in my room again without my homework, you won't be going back to my classroom again." From that day forward, I did all my math homework.
This is Troy Mills from Palm Beach, Florida. It's funny, I was just having this conversation about our best teacher about a week ago with a bunch of old friends from high school via Facebook, and the name that kept popping up was Mrs. Bouchard. It seemed like everybody else could not stand this woman. She was just really, really tough. Every week we learned 20 really long, insane words that we would never use in daily life. And everybody just thought she was this mean, vile, wretched witch of a woman. And I met her a year or two later when I wasn't in her class, and she was lighthearted, jovial, and really, really a sweet lady. So I give Mrs. Bouchard from Ely High School down in Broward County kudos for being tough but fair and an inspiration that really pushed us.
Who was your best teacher? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, to leave a comment. Coming up, we're going to talk about that controversy in Atlanta over the white sorority that won the stepping contest.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we're going to talk about a controversy in Atlanta over a stepping competition. That's a particular form of dance that's associated with African Americans. And we're asking you, when do you own your own culture and when does it belong to all of us?
Your question about judging white dancers in a traditionally black art or dance form is an age-old question. It's the one that white jazz musicians have faced for years, whether or not they can play jazz music, which is traditionally a black art form. And no, blacks don't own the stepping dance form the same way blacks don't own jazz.
Okay, we're asking you. You can give us your response at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org. That conversation in a moment. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 31 minutes after the hour. In the past 20 minutes, Pentagon Police Chief Richard Keevil spoke at a press conference about last night's shootout just outside the Pentagon. Two police officers were wounded when a gunman, 36-year-old John Patrick Bedell, approached a security checkpoint, pulled a gun from his pocket, and opened fire.
He was very well armed. I will tell you, he had 2 9-millimeter semi-automatic weapons and many magazines.
The shooter was killed when the officers returned fire. Doctors say the cops were only grazed and will be okay. We're also learning that the shooter reportedly posted messages on the internet showing resentment toward the military and doubting the facts behind the September 11th attacks. Iraqis living abroad have begun casting their votes in the homeland's parliamentary elections. The United Nations estimates more than 2 million Iraqis have fled the country since the U.S.-led invasion. General David Petraeus, the commanding general for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, tells Charlie Rose the election is an important milestone.
The outcome of this election will define the subsequent 4 years for a country that is of enormous geostrategic importance.
The polls open in Iraq on Sunday.
In Washington now, the Washington Post is reporting that President Obama is close to receiving a recommendation from advisors that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed be prosecuted in a military tribunal instead of civilian court. The White House initially wanted to try the proclaimed mastermind of the 9/11 attacks in Manhattan. If the president accepts the recommendation, Congress could approve the funding needed to close the Guantanamo Bay prison and replace it with a facility in the U.S. February unemployment numbers come out in two 2 hours, economists expect a small rise to 9.8% unemployment. And that is affecting global markets this morning. Asian and European markets are up. The futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,444. The S&P opens at 1,122. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,292. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We're talking this morning about whether or not one race or one ethnic group can own a particular art form. Do Latins own salsa? Do people from the South, whites from the South, own country music? Do blacks own stepping? There was a step competition recently. Step is a kind of dance that has deep roots in African-American culture, dating all the way back to African stomping dance. But in a recent national competition, a group of white college students from Arkansas beat out their black competitors, and they took home a $100,000 prize. Until the judge reversed their original decision and decided the black students from Indiana had tied the white team. And for the students, the competition ended there. For the rest of us, that's the beginning of this conversation. Joining us is LaToya Peterson. She's editor of the website racealicious.com. And also with us is Lester Spence, political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. But Lester, a stepping dancer at your fraternity when you were going to school, right?
Well, I'm not a step dancer, but I marched.
You marched. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's a little different
thing.
So
whenever I hear dance and stepping, the two don't really go together for me.
Yeah, they... okay. Well, you know, this step... I love step. I can't get enough of this, but it is very associated with historically black colleges. It's very associated with the black fraternities and black sororities. It's kind of been owned for a very long time by African Americans in college. Explain to us this competition and why this particular form of art is so central to African American culture.
So stepping begins in black fraternities and sororities. Around the World War II era, what happens is black fraternity members who had service in the military start to bring that type of military precision and performance into their fraternities, and then sororities later picked up on it. And it's a way for us to emphasize pride in our organizations, and it's also a way for us to express the values of group cooperation, group initiative, and group loyalty.
Okay. So, LaToya, in this competition in Atlanta, and you watch these videos, both of these groups that eventually took home a prize were extremely good. But when the white team competed, the audience went crazy. They were cheering and they were on their feet. It was an incredible routine. But when they won, when that was announced, this is what the crowd said.
All right, y'all. Let me reiterate that this is from the judges' scores. That is what we are doing here.
So, LaToya, I should emphasize that the judges were African-American. So why the difference? Why cheering for them while they perform and then not okay with it when they win?
Interestingly enough, some of our commenters pointed out that some of it could have been due to the novelty of seeing a white team, which would have got them kind of a higher crowd participation. And so you would have accounted for some of the cheering that you saw initially. But I don't think necessarily that the audience, which appears to be a predominantly black from the limited screen, limited panning that I saw, expected them to actually go ahead and take the entire competition. And I feel like it's kind of the routines themselves were fairly close. It kind of comes down to what you were looking for in a step routine, where the AKAs had a lot more creativity in their moves, and they were a little bit more loose in their interpretation of what the step routine should be, whereas the ZTA team was definitely a lot more regimented, and they did a lot more heavier stepping. They also had a lot more people on their team to execute more of the moves.
ZTA was the white sorority that won originally. And I want to ask you, Lester, did you get a chance to see the videos of these two teams?
I saw them both, and I saw them both again. What's really important for listeners to realize is that the judges were black, but none of them were in fraternities or sororities. Anthony Anderson is an actor. I love his work. I think he's an excellent comedian, but he doesn't really know much about stepping. So what that really means is while they're able to say this is really good versus this not, they're not really able to judge between two really close groups. So when I saw the show, the AKs did a one-legged step. That's really, really, really difficult to pull off, right? I mean, on that step alone, I would have given them the prize, but I can understand why the judges booed. I mean, why the audience booed. It's partially a racial thing, but it's also partially a testimony on the judges kind of being illegitimate.
Okay, but LaToya, it feels to me like we're kind of missing the point here, which is that at some point, a white team is going to win, and there will be no argument about merits. It's just that, you know, the judges' scores you have to accept, right? I mean, that's just it. I mean, does it matter what color the team is?
It ultimately shouldn't, but this is kind of like the step version of getting a Starbucks in your neighborhood. A lot of people are wary, and they're having this backlash, and it's prompted all of this discussion, not necessarily because this one team shouldn't have won, but it's more because it's kind of a harbinger of things to come. And I believe one of your listeners had brought up the fact that, you know, blacks don't own jazz. But there's this history of erasure from art forms that we began or that we started. And, you know, combine that with the fact that white artists in, you know, what's quote-unquote a black space get disproportionately more media attention. Like, would we have heard about this step competition if the winners weren't white? Which puts some interesting dynamics into the question. I don't think it's so much about ZTA winning this one competition. In the grand scheme of things, it's not that big of a deal. You know, they were involved in stepping. They became involved in stepping as part of a unity night at their college. So a black team actually taught them, and they swapped traditions, and that's how they've been stepping for 16 or so years.
And they clearly love it. LaToya Peterson, editor of the website racialicious.com, Lester Spence, political science professor at Johns Hopkins. We're wondering what you think. What is your take on this whole issue? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post a comment to thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the new movie Brooklyn's Finest comes out today. We're going to talk with one of the stars and the director. Most of us watch the Oscars, we're watching the movie stars, even in the audience. But if you're a movie star on Oscars night, you're probably looking at two accountants. We're talking about the accountants from PricewaterhouseCoopers, the guys with the briefcases who hit the red carpet each year holding the ballots, the winning envelopes. We're joined by those accountants today, Rick Rosas, he's been the Oscar ballot team leader since 2001, and Brad Oltmans, who's been co-leader since 2004. So Rick, how does one get selected for the duty of handcuffing oneself to the suitcase full of ballots?
Well, let me dispel an urban legend right away. We are not handcuffed to the ballots or the
Dang, that was the best part of the story.
Better than being handcuffed to the briefcase, we're actually escorted individually by one of LAPD's finest for the entirety of the day, whose sole job is to protect that briefcase.
And they handcuff you?
No, they don't handcuff us. If we actually go down, their duty is to grab the briefcase and run, and hopefully we'll get help.
Has anybody ever attempted to breach your security? Is there ever any attempts at theft, or have any, say, gossip reporters called you up and offered you elaborate bribes?
There's never been any attempts at theft, but a few times on the red carpet, I've been asked the question, what are you going to do if I grab that briefcase out of your hands? And what I always say is, I'm not going to do anything, but the guy behind me has a gun.
You know, I understand that there's this story from 1973 where accountant Robert Ford nearly got trampled by a streaker that ran across the Oscar stage. And from what I understand, this has been the subject of accountant conferences for a good 30 years running since then. Has anything ever happened to you while you were performing your duties?
Nothing of the level that Bob Ford had to deal with. Although, as I recall, that year David Niven got the best line in on that whole episode.
Probably the only laugh that man will ever get in his life is by stripping off and showing his shortcomings.
That is exactly what we said. Is it a kind of a thing that, I mean, do you guys come back after the Oscars with stories of celebrities and share them among the coffee office?
Sometimes.
Okay, who's the nicest person backstage? Who's the most real person?
For me, the one that really stands out is someone I met my first year on the red carpet, and that was Julia Roberts. I just thought she was, very friendly, and she was enjoying being a presenter on the show. So it made it a lot of fun for me to meet her, hand her an envelope, and share a couple of laughs before she went on the stage.
We heard a rumor, though, that she asked you to tell her who'd won.
Yeah, it wasn't me. It was one of our former colleagues, and of course he did his job and kept a straight face throughout the whole thing.
He politely said no. And for you, who's your who's the most your favorite backstage?
For me, there's been two. The one that sometimes surprises people. The first was Julie Andrews, who was just the most gracious and charming person I'd met. She lived up to everything I would have expected out of Julie Andrews. The other was Russell Crowe.
Really?
Just really nice guy. He was fun. kidded around a lot, and it was almost disarming because it was my first year too, and I think I'd heard a lot of the rumors around Russell Crowe, and so I had some trepidation about meeting him, and he actually ended up being great.
We've also been at the receiving end of some kidding and comments from comedians like Robin Williams and Jack Black as we've been waiting in the green room, and that's always probably the only thing that we're nervous about each year is the time that we're going to spend being the warm-up act for the comedians.
They're going to make fun of you?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're like a hanging curveball to them.
Oh, Brad Altman's and Rick Rosas of PricewaterhouseCoopers. If nothing else, you've at least held up not only the honesty of the accounting profession, but also you've shown that accountants do indeed have a sense of humor. They are part of the Academy Awards ballot counting team from PricewaterhouseCoopers. Thanks so much, guys, for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of dumbing down a resume in order to land a job. Is feeding a family a greater moral imperative than telling employers the truth? Where do you draw the line? ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley, joined today by Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. And we're going to be talking about movies today. The new movie Brooklyn's Finest comes out. And we'll be talking with Antoine Fuqua and star John Cheadle in a few moments. But we have a trivia question for you, as we do every Friday. In the past 50 years, only two cop movies have won Best Pictures at the Oscars. What are they? Give us your best guess at the Facebook fan page, facebook.com/thetakeaway, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now let's check in on the headlines at 48 minutes past the hour.
Two police officers were hurt when a man walked up to them outside the Pentagon subway station last night and opened fire. Police returned fire on the man, John Patrick Bedell of California, and he later died. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Keevil describes what happened.
He walked up wearing a coat and just reached in his pocket, pulled out a gun, and started shooting.
We're joined now by Ian Urbina, a reporter from our partner, the New York Times, with more from Washington, D.C. Ian, what can you tell us about the suspect in this case?
There's not a whole lot known yet about him. Pentagon investigators are looking into whether Bedell was a disgruntled 9/11 conspiracy theorist. It seems that he made some postings on a couple of internet sites that seemed to imply he had some issues with the government, and that he may have driven all the way from California to the Pentagon to settle those scores. There's also a strange wrinkle, which is that one of the internet postings alludes to an individual, an Army officer who died and for whom suicide was the official cause of death, but around whom there was all sorts of speculation that there may have been something else going on there.
Again, two officers wounded in that attack at the Pentagon, and the shooter was killed. Ian Urbina from our partner, the New York Times, thanks for joining us from Washington. Overseas now, a strong aftershock has shaken one of the cities in Chile's worst affected areas by last Saturday's earthquake. The aftershock in Concepcion sent people running into the streets. Also in Chile, relief worker Andres Vera has been describing the scene in one coastal village where the seawater was contaminated into the drinking water supply.
The ocean got into the city. Many fish were left in the city. So you go to the cities and towns and you start smelling the rotten fish.
3 days of national mourning have been declared in Chile. That will begin on Sunday.
Back at home, President Obama wants the House to pass the health care bill before he leaves for a trip to Asia in mid-March. He invited more than a dozen House Democrats to the White House yesterday to drum up support for his proposals. And the Department of Education named 16 finalists in the first round of its Race to the Top competition. The contest awards more than $4 billion in grants to states that adopt innovative programs to improve student performance. Among the winners, Colorado, New York, and Georgia. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Today the film Brooklyn's Finest hits theaters nationwide. It's the latest film from Training Day's director Antoine Fuqua, and it follows three cops who are forced to make some impossible decisions during tense moments in their lives and then live with the consequences of those decisions. The all-star cast includes Richard Gere, Ethan Hawke, Wesley Snipes, Ellen Barkin, and Don Cheadle, who stopped by our studio along with Antoine Fuqua to speak with me and John Hockenberry. John asked the director how they got this indie film made outside the normal studio system.
Well, basically, you know, we had to go out and raise the money, but the key was to get the actors. I mean, the guy that wrote the script's a first-time writer, so it was a difficult time to find the money in this sort of film.
He's a former subway worker, right?
Yeah, he worked at the subway. Yeah, he was still working there while we were shooting, actually.
Yeah. Not so former at the time.
Yeah, well, he knew the scene and the setting. And really, in some ways, the making of this film was also a guerrilla filmmaking around the three boroughs of New York where it was shot. Tell me some of the stories of how you took these very famous actors into these settings and tried to shoot on the fly.
Mm. Well, I mean, I had to go up there a month ahead of time and have a few meetings. I had to meet with the so-called gang members and, you know, all that, the police. And some of the police basically said, if you go in there, you're on your own. And they were dead serious about that. And when they finally did give us the permission to go in there, once they found out who all the actors were, they added a lot of cops. I had to pay some of the gang members some money and keep them working with us. And they helped. And the Nation of Islam. Because we had, you know, obviously all these great actors in this area. But they embraced them. They were great. They helped. You know, they have opinions about
you
know, authenticity. I mean, you know, for me, that's the only way to make the movie.
Well, actor Don Cheadle, does that add to the authenticity of doing a scene in a situation where you know you've had to negotiate your presence, where you're really in the place where something like this would occur?
Yeah, I mean, I was very appreciative to have the ability to work in the area where, you know, we were depicting in the film, and I thought that it was a testament to Antoine's ability and the entire staff around Antoine to kind of work with the community and get us to a place where, you know, I never felt that I was in danger. I know people said it was a dangerous place to be, and it can be at times, depending on when and where, but I never felt in danger. I felt it really lent itself to helping the film.
Well, you play a character named Tango. Right?
Yeah.
He's an undercover cop. He's desperate to get off the streets and to get a real job, right?
Yeah.
Here's a clip.
You get in touch with Alyssa.
She sent these, the divorce papers. You know, I got some lawyers' names in there for you, a list of them. And got the department taking care of everything for you, okay?
I want my life back, Bill.
I can see that. And I'm working on it.
Please. Work harder.
So in order to get your promotion, Tango, and to save his marriage, to basically get his life back, you've got to make an impossible decision.
Yeah, he's got to look at the proposition of turning over his man, Kaz, played by Wesley Snipes in the film, making him a target of his investigation and taking him down. And this is someone who, like Tango, is saying, I want out. I don't want to be in the game anymore. The game is, there's no future in it, and he wants to be gone. So it's a tough position to be in where you have to take down the, you know, this guy who helped my character in prison and kind of saved my life, and now he's got to go if I want to get out.
Everybody wants to get out in this movie, right?
Everyone's under pressure, some sort of pressure. I mean, Tango in particular, his pressure is, you know, the friendship. Getting his wife back, getting his life back is what he wants the most. He's a guy that believed in the administration and the system. He was a good cop, and he walks that fine line because he's in the world as an undercover cop, and he has to walk that fine line. One of the things we discovered in making his movies is a police officer's biggest fear is the administration. You make one false move, and you find yourself on the other side of the law. Internal affairs is all over you. So here's a guy that's done everything right, paid his dues. He's under extreme pressure, and he sees himself beginning to psychologically break. And he's begging this guy to get him out of this situation so he can get his life back.
Do you embrace these moral dilemmas, Don Cheadle? I mean, you're in Hotel Rwanda, okay? Morally overwhelming choices there in this movie, yet also, you know, all the Ocean 11 movies, not a lot of morality there.
No, they're with it there. He's with the criminality there, 100%. You know, and it was funny because I had just come off of the film Traitor, and Antoine and I spoke a lot about a lot of similar themes. You know, this character who's got this duplicitous nature about him and is a mask within a mask, and how do we play that? And what are the beats that are similar, what are the beats that are different, and really that was a source of a lot of the conversations that Antoine and I had about how to play this, and who does he hold counsel with, and when do we get to see who he really is. And it's one of those situations where what we discovered when we were working on Traitor is that, you know, the audience is the only person who knows as much in those scenes as Tango knows. So really, your contract is with the camera in a way, and how do we shoot this so that we can really see what's going on inside of Tango that these other characters in the scene can't see.
Which means you can't know how it's going to come out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They yeah. can't know.
Which means the script writer is just one piece of the movie making.
Oh, yeah. That's just a blueprint.
Well, audiences will know how it turns out when they actually go to see the movie. And there actually is an extraordinary twist in the film. We don't want to give it away. You'll never guess who's left standing
right.
in Brooklyn's Finest. That's all. Don Cheadle, thanks so much. Star of Brooklyn's Finest, Hotel Rwanda, and all the Ocean's 11 movies. And the various
upcoming Iron Man movie.
That's right.
Well?
That's right.
Yeah, I play a similar duplicitous character in that.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a whole range of duplicitous characters.
Now, you're not getting pegged as duplicitous John Cheadle, are you?
I want to. I don't know if I can do
he
it.
He could be lying to
looking
us right
for,
now.
I am, actually.
Looking for a brand, yes, in the latter stages of his career. Antoine Fuqua, director of Brooklyn's Finest and Training Day. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
That was director Antoine Fuqua and Don Cheadle talking to us about their new movie, Brooklyn's Finest. It's out today.
Now, before we go, Celeste, we need an answer to your trivia question.
Yeah, right. Only two cop movies have won Best Picture at the Oscars in the last 50 years. What were they? First, In the Heat of the Night.
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
And second, more recently, The Departed.
Costello was my informant.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.